background, we need an introduction to the Plishtim. So I'm excited because for the first time, we're gonna break out some maps, which we're gonna have some more of these. Maps will be very helpful for understanding a lot of Sefer Shmuel as we go forward. We haven't really needed it at the first three prakim because all the action was happening in the Mishkan, right? We were focused on Eli and Chana and Bnei Eli and Shmuel, right? All the action was happening in Shiloh. Now, for the first time, we're bringing in the geopolitics that are happening in Sefer Shmuel, and in order to understand that, we need to know the lay of the land. Okay, so let's bring this back. So, we'll talk about the Plishtim, who the Plishtim are, and why they are such a threat. Before we do that, we should just have a general introduction to what the geostrategic, geopolitical, military situation in Eretz Yisrael and the general Middle East is, right? So if you see the first map over here, can I make it bigger? I can't. Okay, fine. So the first map on the left, right? You just see you have Egypt over here, you know, you have Babylonia over here, and you have the Hittite Empire over here. What this is the good old Fertile Crescent, right? I literally just put Fertile Crescent into Google. And what you see very nicely from this map is that when we think about the Middle East historically, so there always are three major potential centers of power which control the region. And throughout Tanakh and down till this very day, that remains the case, right? This whole middle area, including Eretz Yisrael, the Egyptians at times are in charge. In Bavel, sometimes they're in charge of Babylonia, and sometimes Turkey, right? You never have a major empire in Eretz Yisrael. You never have a major empire, you know, in Lebanon or in Syria. This is the in-between land between the great empires, right? In Bias Rishon, it's Egypt versus Ashur, Egypt versus Bavel, right? Then, you know, we think of the Hanukkah story, we think of the Greeks running the show, but really in the Hanukkah story, it's the Syrian Greeks, the Seleucid Empire over here versus the Ptolemy Empire in Egypt, and Eretz Yisrael is in between. Middle Ages, right? You have the Fatimid, you have the Abbasid Caliphate, the Fatimid Caliphate, the Byzantine Empire, the Ottoman Empire. All of history, with two exceptions, but for all of history, the Middle East is dominated in one of these three areas, right? One exception to all of history is Rome, and the Ramban actually talks about that in his commentary on the Tochacha in Parshas Vechukosai, when the Ramban is explaining what's so extraordinary about the second Tochacha in Kisavo. So he says, well, the Pesukim there talk about the land being controlled by a faraway nation. And the Ramban says that refers to Rome, because that's the one time in all of human history, down to this very day, by the way, where those are not the controlling power is from totally outside this whole area. Right now, it's a little bit out of the news, but what's going on in Syria? Syria, you have a stalemate between, you know, people who are supported by Iran versus armies which are supported by Turkey, right? This always has been the middle battleground between these three major power groups. The other exception is nowadays, right, where Eretz Yisrael, Baruch Hashem, is independent, right, and has the ability to influence things going on in the region. And the reason for this is very simple. It's because you have rivers in Egypt and in Turkey and in Babylonia, which can support a population that is just far bigger than anything you'll ever have in between, right? As Pasuk in Devarim says that you know, Eretz Yisrael relies on rainfall, and Jewish independence is not something that should exist purely through nature. Purely through nature, the neighbors in the Middle East should be able to dominate the region, right? If we're good, listen to the Torah, then Hashem gives us rain, Hashem gives us the ability and protection, and we're able to be an independent power. But by pure, you know, dry military logic, this area, this in-between area, should not be able to maintain its independence. It's normally dominated by one of these three power centers. So when we look at the period of the Tanakh that we're talking about now, right? Beginning of Shmuel Aleph, and before that, Sefer Shoftim. So the historians, I'll talk about this, is like, this is an early Dark Age. Happens to have been at a time where all the major empires in the region had collapsed. Egypt is going through huge turmoil. The Hittite Empire is collapsed. The Assyrian Empire has collapsed. That creates for several centuries a massive vacuum where all the local powers in Eretz Yisrael have independence. And if we think about the countries that Bnei Yisrael fight in Sefer Shoftim, so it's predominantly, we just call the minor powers all around Eretz Yisrael, right? Ammon and Moab, Midian, right? Gideon fights against Midian. You have Devorah against the remnants of Canaan, who had not been defeated still by Yehoshua. For the most part, the enemies in Sefer Shoftim are not a major geopolitical threat. Yehoshua handles the major threat, the collective power of the Canaanim. He wipes out many of them, scatters the rest, and you no longer have a national threat posed by Canaan to Eretz Yisrael. That's why when Devorah tries to gather an army to fight against Sisera, remember, she's not able to get all the Shvatim to sign on, because Canaan post-Yehoshua no longer has the ability to threaten the entire country. It's a local threat in the valley of the Galil. But you no longer have enemies which are national threats. Ammon gives problems, you know, local problems to Yiftach. And Moab gives some local problems to Ehud. And Midian gives some local problems that Gideon has to deal with. You don't have a sweeping national threat from a real major military power. We think about Sefer Malachim. These countries over here, for the most part, are under are dominated by either Malchut Yisrael or Malchut Yehuda. Edom is usually a vassal in Sefer Malachim. Moab is usually a vassal in Sefer Malachim. Right? There is a war when Moab rebels against Achav and Yehoshaphat. No, it's not Yerav. It's not Achav. It's the one after Achav. Anyway, so that's the story in Sefer Shoftim. Right, the first half of Shoftim, they're not facing major threats. But that all transforms at the end of Shoftim and coming into Shmuel, right? Because all of a sudden, who is the enemy that we're going to be focused on for the entire Sefer? It's the Plishtim. The Plishtim live over here. And now all of a sudden, we see that Am Yisrael is going to have to unite. Because they are facing a new power, which is far more powerful than anything they've had to deal with before. So who are these Plishtim, and where do they come from? So we know about Plishtim in Sefer Bereishis, right, that Abraham deals with and that Yitzchak deals with. The introduction to the Dat Mikra for Shoftim has an essay on this. It's a good one. There are other places you could look as well. But he shows that the Plishtim, it's clear from Tanakh, that the Plishtim were not local to the area. They were not an indigenous people, the same way that Canaan is from here, and Ammon and Moab and Edom, right, which descends from Esav, are all indigenous to the area. There are several psukim which show that the Plishtim came in from, we'll see where. They came from clearly an island. The most likely explanation is that they came from over here. They came from the island of Crete, right, which is the largest of the Greek islands. You have a foreign power invading. seems like some of them came in during, say, for Bracious, but the Plishtim of Bracious basically assimilate to Kanani culture, right? Think about Avimelech, the king of Gerar. So he has a Hebrew name, right? His name is Avimelech. Whether it means my father is king, or whether it means my father is Molech, the Kanani god. But they basically, those Kananim assimilate, and they're a minor power, right? We don't really find any battles between Yehoshua and the land of Gerar, right? That doesn't seem to be a problem. Over the course of Sefer Shoftim, more and more Plishtim are coming in. There's all this turmoil happening in Greece, and they are being chased out, seems like is what's happening. They come to land of Israel. They're actually in Egypt. There are not hieroglyphics, but there are inscriptions, illustrated inscriptions. The Plishtim try to take over Egypt, right? Because remember, the goal, if you want to control the Middle East, they have to control one of these three power centers, right? Egypt, Turkey, or Iraq. So the Plishtim land all around, all around the coast, and they march on Egypt. They try to take over Egypt. They're turned back. They fail. And so they're living now on the coast of Israel. But they are a very powerful, very militarily organized force. They are not ruled by kings. They are ruled by what the Tanakh calls a saranim, whether those are tyrants or military officers. They have highly advanced technology. We'll see that when we learn about Goliath. Remember Goliath's armor and his weapons. This is an organized, conquering, militaristic society. It's been becoming more and more powerful over the course of Sefer Shoftim. And one way to think about it is, as a consequence of Klal Yisrael blowing it time and time again, when their enemies are weak, at the beginning of Shoftim, they're fighting Ammon and Moab and Midian, right? And they keep on sinning. So Hashem says, okay, fine, right? We're going to bring, now we're going to bring a real threat, right? We're going to bring in the threat of the Plishtim. Now, to look at some of the psukim that they quote, you see enough. And it's like, it's really interesting. It's very clear. Right, Parshas Noach over here goes through the nations. So it tells us about Pasrusim v'kas luchim asher yatsu misham. I don't know where these places are, but there are some places at which left from there the Plishtim and the Kaftorim. So Plishtim and Kaftorim are being linked with each other in Sefer Bereishis. You go to Sefer Dvarim, and Moshe and Dvarim is telling Bnei Yisrael, right, that you're going to come into the land of Canaan, and you're going to be intimidated because how are you going to conquer the mighty Canaanim who are living there? But Moshe tells them, you should know, this is not the first time in history that Hashem has allowed one nation to come in and take over. He says, Hashem already allowed Esav to conquer the land of Seir, and they're living there now. And then in Perek Beis, Pasuk Kaf Gimel, take a look, Hashem, Moshe tells Klal Yisrael, V'ha'avim hayoshvim v'chatzirim ad aza kaftorim hayotzim mi kaftor. So the kaftorim are who came from this place of kaftor. So they came to Aza, they destroyed them, and they took over, right? So Moshe is telling Bnei Yisrael, there are these people from kaftor who are coming, or beginning to come in to Aza, right? And they are conquering the land. So Kaftor, Plishtim, Kaftorim. So Amos, just a couple more psukim. Amos has a pasuk where he says, I took Israel from the land of Egypt. And he says, I took the Plishtim from Kaftor. So the Plishtim, Kaftorim, Plishtim, it sounds like whether they were, originally separate tribes and gradually they merged. Ammon and Moab are kind of like this, right? Sometimes Ammon is predominant, and sometimes Moab is predominant, but it's basically one family, right? Yishmael and Bnei Keturah, eventually they kind of blend into one family, one nation. That seems to have happened from Sefer Bereishis to the time of Amos. So the Plishtim and the Kaftor are basically one of the same, but they came out of a foreign land, and now they are coming into the land of Gaza. And a couple more, one more. Yirmiyahu, right, tells us that this place Kaftor is an island. And he says, Hush, Yirmiyahu, and he's getting, you know, the end of the book of Yirmiyahu, when, okay, we have 43 prakim of Yirmiyahu, you know, ripping on Bnei Yisrael. So towards the end, you get the parts of Yirmiyahu that you're not allowed to learn on Tisha B'Av, right? Because Yirmiyahu says, okay, let's take a break from beating up on Bnei Yisrael, and let's talk about everything that's going to happen to all the nations all around. So Yirmiyahu has a parak about the destruction of the Plishtim, and Yirmiyahu says that Hashem is going to destroy the Plishtim, the remnant of E Kaftor, the island of Kaftor. So you have enough of these psukim, the Plishtim, the Kaftorim, the Plishtim are coming from Kaftor, they're coming from the island of Kaftor. So you put it together, and it seems like that's the consensus. Again, just to go back up to the map for a second, the Plishtim originate probably over here in Crete, right? The historians call them the Sea Peoples. And then over time, as there's turmoil in Greece, they leave over here. They make landings all over the coast. They try to conquer Egypt. They fail. And so they're living now here along the coast in Eretz Canaan. And this is creating a major national security headache for Klal Yisrael at this period of time. Because until now, they've only had to deal with the local, you know, rinky-dinky enemies like Amun and Moab. Now all of a sudden they have to deal with something which is far more powerful, right? This land this island of Kaftor, actually, past a couple of psukim, explicitly call it Kretim. Kaftor and Kretim seem like the same place. Kretim, of course, being the Hebrew name for Crete, right? Crete being this island in the Mediterranean, right? Tzafania talks about the Plishtim who are coming from Kretim, right? And, you know, Tzafania, who is a little bit before Yirmiyahu, so just like Yirmiyahu prophesied about the coming destruction of the Plishtim, so Tzafania says the same thing. And even already in Sefer Shmuel, we'll get to this eventually, when David is chasing after the Amalekim, right, who raid Tzilkag, so he's told about these Amalekim went on a raid, and they raided the Negev HaKreti, right? So what's the Negev HaKreti? That sounds like it's the part of the Negev which is where the Plishtim live. And that really sounds like where our Sefer Bereishis Plishtim live, right? The Sefer Bereishis Plishtim in Gerar, remember, that's near Be'er Sheva, right? So you have early Plishtim, Kretim in the Negev, and then you have the more powerful Plishtim who are establishing dominion on the coast. And that is what is giving Bnei Yisrael a much more difficult time than anything they've had to deal with until now. So that is like the general perspective on you know, geopolitics of the time of Sefer Shmuel, right? So now let's look at the specific battle. I'm going to unshare this for a second because I want to be able to zoom out a little bit to get the whole map for what's coming up next. Because what we're going to look at, right, we're going to have the first major battle, and I want everyone to be able to see where this battle takes place and where basically all the battles are going to take place throughout Sefer Shmuel. So if we understand this now, it'll be very helpful as we go forward, because it's going to be basically the same exact story is going to repeat itself time and time again. Where Bnei Yisrael and the Plishtim are fighting, what the strategies are, why things are happening, where they're happening. Okay, so what you see on the left is the topography of Eretz Yisrael. And we can think of Eretz Yisrael really as divided up, we can divide it vertically into four lines, and we can divide it horizontally as well. When we think vertically, so right up against the Mediterranean, you have the coastal plain, right, which is flat, and that is the most fertile area of the country. It's the most economically valuable because this is the major road from Egypt over there, right, to Turkey and to Bavel. Since it's flat, it is where chariots are able to ride. At this time, there's no such thing as mounted cavalry. Soldiers are not riding on horses. They do not yet really have horses that they've bred that are strong enough to support soldiers with armor. So the cavalry ride on chariots, but that's only doable in the plains. So that's what you have over here. As we move east, so you have the Shvela, the hill country, which is the low hills as we get closer and closer to the middle of the country. Then in the spine of the country, you have the mountain ranges, right? Hare Yehuda in the south, Har Ephraim, which is mentioned a number of times in Sefer Shmuel, in the north. Those are the mountain ranges. And then you have by the Jordan River, you have the Jordan River Valley over here. So the main battle between the Plishtim and Bnei Yisrael is going to be as follows. The Plishtim conquer the coast. They have access to chariots. They have cavalry. They completely take over the entire coast. You see them over here, right? The Plishtim are dominating down here. There are some Canaanite remnants that Bnei Yisrael never fully got rid of. And the Plishtim are extending their dominion to those areas as well. So up the plain over here, and then you have the valley, Emek Yisrael, which is over here. So the Plishtim are basically setting up a backwards number one, right? All along the coastal plain, and then Emek Yisrael, they are establishing dominion over the whole area that's flat. If it's flat, you can use chariots. And Bnei Yisrael had problems with chariots in Sefer Yehoshua. They won a huge battle, but it was the most difficult battle they fought. But now, if they're chariots at this point in time by Sefer Shmuel, the Jews are not doing well. Bnei Yisrael are based in the mountain ranges, Yehuda, right, Har Ephraim. Chariots cannot operate over there, so it's a much more difficult campaign for the Plishtim to mount, especially because, remember, the Plishtim are foreign invaders. They do not have the same size population that Bnei Yisrael has. So this is where Bnei Yisrael are. And then you have the low country, the Shvela, in the middle. So every single battle that we find Bnei Yisrael having with the Plishtim are coming from this way, Bnei Yisrael come from that way, right? They meet somewhere-ish in the middle. And what the Plishtim are going to try to do is, how are they going to invade? How do they want to take over the land of Eretz Yisrael? They'll find one of the passes, one of the valleys, to try to come in invading east. So that's why almost every single time we find the Plishtim fighting with Bnei Yisrael in Shmuel, there's going to be a valley somewhere, right? Because the Plishtim are trying to break out from the coastal plain to take over in the mountainous area. And Bnei Yisrael are going to try to find a place at one of the mountain passes where they are going to try to stop them. So that is general introduction to what the map is going to look like. And this is going to occur time and time again. So now let's scroll down one more page. Our last map of the day. And we'll finally be able to look at some sukkim. So you'll see, this is the map that the Dat Mikra, Dat Mikra Atlas has of the first battle, right? The Battle of Ophek, which is a complete disaster for Bnei Yisrael. So it's small, I'm sorry, but you'll see they fight right here. This is Dat Mikra thinks they fight here at Ophek. This is the first of the battles, right? At the edge, as you leave the coastal plain and you get farther east, so this is the first battle that Bnei Yisrael fight with the Plishtim. And you see, at this point, the Jews are not yet dominated by the Plishtim. So the battle is pretty close to Plishti territory, right? The Plishtim have not yet succeeded in making inroads farther east. Later battles, we'll see, are going to be closer to Jewish territory. But right now, they're going to fight over here. Spoiler alert, Jews are going to lose. It's going to be a disaster. And look at the red arrows. Look how far the Plishtim are going to break in. They're going to break in all the way to the center of the country, to the core of Har Ephraim. They're going to come to Shiloh. They're going to destroy Shiloh, and they're going to destroy the Mishkan. But you can see from the map what a disaster this battle is going to be, because it starts over here at the edge of the coastal plain, And the Plishtim managed to break through and invade and conquer all the way into the core of the mountain territory. So it's left as a total disaster. B'nai Yisrael at the end of this parak will hit rock bottom. It's not going to get worse than it is at the end of this parak, but it's going to be, it's pretty bad. So now that we know what things are looking like on the ground, let's look at some of the psukim. This week we'll look at what the Navi does with the battle, and then next week we'll look at what the Navi does with the aftermath of the battle in parak bottom. I'm just going to unshare one more time because I want to be able to zoom in so the psukim aren't tiny. So just give me 1 second. And make this nice and big. Seder. Okay. So now it begins our parak tal. We're told, Vayidvar Shmuel l'chol Yisrael. So the word of Shmuel came to all of Israel. Vayetze Yisrael l'krap plishtim l'melchama. And the Jews went out to fight a war with the plishtim. And the Jews camp at Evan Ezer and the Plishtim camp at Afek. Okay, now from the map we know where those are. But it's a very strange juxtaposition in the Pasuk, right? Torah's Navi says, the word of Shmuel went out to Israel, and Israel fought a battle with the Plishtim. So what exactly do those two things have to do with each other? It almost sounds like Shmuel told the people to go to war, and then they went to war. That's actually how Radak interprets the Pasuk, but it's very, very difficult because, of course, they're going to lose. So why would Shmuel tell them to go to battle, which they then lose, and then afterwards Shmuel still is the Navi? Shmuel's going to be the leader of Klal Yisrael after this. So Radak tries to interpret the Pasuk that way, but it's difficult. And it's not how Rashi understands it. We should look at what Rashi says, and then Abarbanel is going to have a piece on top, which is going to be important for understanding some of the corruption that has taken root in Israel at this time. Rashi just writes that, remember, in the aftermath at the end of Parak Gimel, we were told that Shmuel has now become the Navi, right? Shiloh's been restored. There are other Nevi'im at this time. There seems to be some little bit of a spiritual renaissance. So Rashi says it was Shmuel's prophecy that the sons of Eli were going to be destroyed, that disaster was happening. Remember, Shmuel had his nevuah where Hashem said, anyone who hears this, their ears will ring. So Rashi explains that Shmuel's prophecy came to B'nai Yisrael, but nonetheless, right? How did the disaster happen? How did the disaster that Shmuel foretold occur? Because the Jews went to battle with the Plishtim. Now you could wonder, if B'nai Yisrael know about Shmuel's prophecy, why are they just blithely going off to war? So Abarbanel picks up on this, and Abarbanel says this was a major failure. That's what the Navi wants to flag, that Klal Yisrael knew Shmuel's prophecy, and nonetheless they ignored it. The way Abarbanel reads the Pasuk is, Israel knows Shmuel's prophecy. Nevertheless, Vayetze Yisrael, their cross plished in the Melchama. Nevertheless, they go out and they array themselves in battle. Mefarshim point out, we do not see the soldiers asking Shmuel what to do. We do not see the Urim Bitumim involved. Normally you go to battle, you ask the Urim Bitumim. David is going to do that in Shmuel Beis. When he fights against the Plishtim, they don't do that. We ended Parak Gimel by being told that after this long drought, there was no prophecy in Israel. Shmuel brings prophecy back, and Klal Yisrael do not take advantage of it. They just go to war. That's how Barbanel says you should read the first pasuk. Then we go to Pesukim Beis and Gimel. Pasuk Beis tells us. So they fight the first battle, and B'nai Yisrael lose. 4,000 casualties, but even though they lose the battle, they have not yet lost the war. So Gimel says, after the defeat, the soldiers go back to the camp. They don't run back home. They go back to the camp. They live to fight another day. And the Navi says, "Vayomruzik Nei Yisrael, Lama Nagafnu Hashem Hayom Lifnei Plishtim." Why did God smite us today against the Plishtim? Very frum of these Akanim, right? Why did Hashem cause us to lose? What are we going to do? So what should the answer be? Daven, tshuva, some fasting. That's the normal religious response to failure. What do they say instead? This is the critical pasuk of the whole parak. Nikcha eleinu mishilo es aron bris Hashem. Let us take the Aron of God. The avo bekirbenu, the yoshienu mikafo yevenu. There's a little bit of ambiguity here how to translate this. You can translate this in one of two ways. Another could be saying, let us take the Aron of Hashem, and God will come among us, and God will save us from our enemies. They also could have translated, let us bring the Aron to our camp. The Aron will come among us, and the Aron will save us from our enemies. Right? Which is probably the easier way to read it. We'll bring the Aron, the Avo Bekirbenu of Yashin Mikafai Avenu. Now, either way, what exactly are Klal Yisrael thinking? Either they think of the Aron as some object of independent power. The Aron will save us, right? Like in Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Aron, this magic box, and you open up the top of it, right, and lightning comes out, and it's going to kill all the Plishtim. That's one possibility. Alternatively, they think that essentially they can force God's hand. God didn't let us win yesterday, but if we bring the Aron to the camp, well, Hashem's going to have to protect the Aron, so we'll force Hashem to come amongst us, and we will force God to save us from our enemies. Either way, what we see here is a completely warped perspective on Hashem's power, right? Because either thinking of the Aron as having power in and of itself, or they think that they can control Hashem. They can tell Hashem what he has to do. This is the exact opposite, as we emphasized when we saw about Chana's tefillah. Chana's whole message was that very, very simple, and it seems so simple. All Chana says is Hashem has unlimited power. Hashem tzivakos. That seems so basic, so elementary, but it's not true. People think Hashem's power is limited. People think they can control what Hashem does. People think there are alternative sources of power. And that is what you see on full display over here. And it's going to lead to total disaster. Now, there's a big machlokas in the Mefarshim. What exactly was the Aron that was being brought? Because, right, this may sound, we've heard of this before, the idea that there was not one Aron, but two, right? Two Arons. Where does that come from? So the Torah and Devarim, when it's rehashing the history of Sefer Shmos. So Moshe says, Hashem told me to make two luchos, and he said, put them in a wooden box. So the problem is, what is the wooden box that Moshe is putting the luchos into? So Rashi comments on this. It's hard to say that it's the Aron, because the Aron is made together with the Mishkan, but the Mishkan is only made after Matan Torah. So Rashi on the spot says there were two Aronos, one for the new Luchos, that's the Aron that's in the Kodesh HaKadashim, one Luchon for the other Luchos, and Rashi says the other Aron was the one Vayhi ben Tsoa Aron Vayomer Moshe, that was the Aron that was in front of the people. They normally brought it to war. And Rashi says the problem with our pasuk, what's new, is for the first time they take Bezalel's Aron, and for the first time they take Bezalel's Aron to war. Okay, other Mefarshim disagree, and the Abarbanel goes on for pages and pages, going back and forth whether there is one Aron or two, and he tries to argue that there is only one. But be that as it may, right? So Rashi is focusing on the fact that they're bringing Bezalel's Aron to the battle when they shouldn't. But what's the deeper problem, right? Like, the problem is not just bringing the Aron. So the Malbim comments on the deeper problems that are going on here. Malbim says, number one, there's Avodah Zarah. He quotes the Pesal Micha. But we'll come back to this idea that the Jews are worshiping the idolatry. We don't really see idolatry here per se, do we? We've seen the sons of Eli be a disaster. We haven't really seen idolatry, at least explicit in the Psukim, yet. But that's one thing the Malbim says. Malbim points out, these guys think they're from, right? They said, you know, why did Hashem strike us? So the phenomenon, which we're thinking about, of people who worship idolatry, but think that they're from. That's one piece the Malbim says. We'll have more to say about it as we go forward. The Malbim adds, this is like the critical point, that they thought that there were limitations on Hashem's power, right? They thought they could bring the Aron here, and that will force Hashem to intervene and save them. And the Malbim says, this is totally incorrect. Zeh machshavas dofi. Totally incorrect way of thinking. Ki bris ha'aron eino tachlis la'atzmo. There's no independent value to the Aron, like they thought. Rak bavur yishruas ha'kasuvbo. Only reason the Aron has any value is because of what's inside it, right? The luchos, the aseres hadibros. If they're not going to follow the aseres hadibros, then Hashem is not going to intervene to protect them. And the Malbim says, additionally, they sinned by bringing the Aron to battle, which was inappropriate. They didn't ask Shmuel what to do. They didn't ask the Urim Tumim. We could say that all of these claims, about Azara, thinking the Aron has separate power, bringing the Aron where they shouldn't, all come from a failure to simply recognize that ultimately the power is with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They should be davening to Hashem. They're not doing that. Instead, they're trying to do tricks and shticks, and they're trying to use some talisman to win the battle. And that is completely the wrong way of thinking. And we're going to probe this at the end of this year, where this whole religious mindset blends with the world of Avodah Zarah the Malbim is picking up. Okay, so right, that was the first battle. They lost. They bring the Aron. They think the Aron is going to save us. We'll bring the Aron and it. Well, what was the passage again? We'll bring the Aron. V'yoshiyin mikafa yivenu. Right, the Aron will save us. So the Aron comes. Eli's two sons are with the Aron. Imagine, visualize them carrying the Aron. And what perfect symbol is this, right, of the warped perspective B'nai Yisrael have, right, is that the Aron is being carried by Chafni and Pinchas, right, the two rampant sinners who profaned the whole Mishkan. They bring the Aron into the camp, right? That's like the perfect expression for where Klal Yisrael are at this point. Pasuk Hey, the Nabi says that when the Aron came, so Klal Yisrael was ecstatic. Says Vayiru Kol Yisrael Tshuva Gedola, right? They shouted with a great shout, Vatehom Haaretz, and the earth rang. So what is this? Remind us of Klal Yisrael having Tshuva and the Aron? It sounds like the battle at Yericho, right, where they had the Aron in front of them and they blew a Tshuva. But there, of course, the reason why they won at Yericho was not because they brought the Aron to the battle, but because Klal Yisrael were still observing the Torah, and Hashem told Yehoshua, here's what to do, and Yehoshua did it, right? So it's like they're trying to imitate the Yericho playbook, but without any of the actual Torah observance that gave them the victory. But there's another parallel here, which is very interesting. The idea that Klal Yisrael, right, they have a big Tshuva, and the earth trembled. If we think back to Chana's Tefillah, the last pasuk of Chana's Tefillah, the one which the Mefarshim explained prophetically anticipated Shmuel's career. So Chana also talked about thundering and trembling, except Chana did not prophesy it happening ba'aretz. Chana prophesied it happening from Shamayim, right? Alav ba'shamayim yareim Hashem, from on high. And then that came to fruition in Perek Zion. We'll get there, right? Times are going to get better. And this is really, really interesting. Navi says, Vayareim Hashem b'kol gadol b'yom habu. Right? Hashem thundered forth. Vayhuman, and the plishtim tremble. So you have this amazing contrast. In the world of Bnei Yisrael, where they are right now, right? Where they think in terms of God's limited power and manipulating the Aron, etc. It is the earth down below which is trembling. Chana, who had the diametrically opposed perspective. Hashem's power is unlimited. And if you want to succeed, you have to daven. And when Shmuel takes over, that's exactly the program that he's going to bring to bear. And he's going to have Bnei Yisrael do tshuva. He's going to have Bnei Yisrael daven before the battle. Then you have Vayirem Hashem, right, up on high. And instead of the trembling on the ground, the thundering is in heaven. And instead of it being the earth that trembles, right, you want a bit of battle. It's very nice to win a battle to have the land be Betei Hama Aretz. But you really want to win, you want to have your enemies trembling, right? They who have plishtim by whom? God made the plishtim tremble. So I think it's doing two things at once, right? We're looking back at Yericho because it's not, you know, they think it's Yericho, but it's really not. But at the same time, it is the opposite religious perspective that Chana and Shmuel have, and it leads to opposite results. So going forward to Pesukim, really the rest of what we'll do for this afternoon, the Plishtim here, the trembling and the vibrating and the noise, and so interesting. The Plishtim panic, and what do the Plishtim say? Right, they know the Aaron is there. They've heard of they know about Hashem. They know about Yetzias Mitzrayim. We talk about Yoshevei Pelashas in Az Yashir. So they panic. They say Ba Elokim El Hamachaneh. Right, they say we're done because God has come into the camp. Right, they think that Hashem has literally come into the camp. And then look at Pasuk Ches. Oylenu miyad silenu. Who's going to save us? Miyad ha-Elohim ha-Adirim ha-Eleh. From these mighty gods. Elohim ha-Elohim ha-Makim ha-Mitzrayim b'chol ma'akam b'dbar. These are the gods which smote Egypt, right, in the desert. What jumps out is the fact that they consistently use the plural. And they use the plural more. Sometimes the Pasuk uses plural for Elohim. But they're calling it they. It really sounds like the Plishtim, their pagan mentality, right? They are translating Hashem in pagan terms. The Malbim says this over here. Makes sense, right? The Plishtim, you have your gods, right? We have our gods. And they just think of the Ribbono Shel Olam as a more powerful version of the gods. So what's kind of sad is that Bnei Yisrael, on the other side of the battlefront, are kind of thinking the same thing, right? They think that Hashem is one, but they also put limitations on Hashem's power. Now the Plishtim then say in Pasuk Tes, they say, His chazku v'yula an Hashem, right? Strengthen yourselves and be men, Plishtim. Pen tavdu le'ivrim, lest you serve the Hebrews as they've served you. V'yisem lan Hashem v'nilchamtem. Be men and fight, right? So the irony is that the Plishtim actually draw strength from the adversity, right? They say, okay, you know, if we're going to go down, we're going to go down fighting. But the Malbim has an absolutely essential analysis of this whole couple of psukim, right? First, as he said, he points out that the Plishtim seem to think of Hashem as, you know, just regular gods. And how exactly does he describe their reaction? So he says, I don't think the Malbim knew that the Plishtim came from Greece. But the Malbim says this is exactly what we find in Greek literature. So interesting. That what was their religious perspective? That heroes could gather strength, and sometimes men can overcome the gods. Now, yeah, in the Iliad, you have this a couple of times where you have a hero who gets inspired by Athena, let's say, and he's able to go and he's able to defeat some of the other gods. So he says that's exactly what the mentality of the Plishtim was. They think of God as powerful, but it's a limited power, and it's one which sometimes heroic human effort can overcome. Right. So that's why the Plishtim say, you know, His chazku v'hiyu la'anashim. Right. He says, let's be mad. Rak hayu anashim shehim b'kach anushotam yitgaru lefemim alei elim v'kachot haniskavot. Sometimes man, you know, really transcends himself and attains a heroic level, can overcome the gods. And that is what the Plishtim are going to try to do. And then finally, the Malbim explains that, remember, the Plishtim say this a second time, right? They say, strengthen yourselves and be men. And then he says, be men and fight. So the Malbim explains the second time. He says, this is just the expression of a militaristic society where they say, you know, worst comes to worst, maybe we'll lose, but we're going to go down fighting, right? At least be men and fight. So this is a militaristic society, explains the Malbim. It is a pagan society that's thinking of gods in the plural. And it's also, you know, a society based on the human-centered values of Greece that thinks of man as being able to overcome the gods. And the tragic irony is that Klal Yisrael, who are trying to manipulate the Ribbono Shel Olam into having to fight on their behalf by bringing the Aron to the camp, really think in the exact same way. The Greeks think, and the Plishtim think, we'll go to battle and defeat the god. And the Beis Yisrael think, we'll bring the Aron here and we'll force Hashem to fight on our behalf. It's the same religious pathology, just on the one hand, the Plishtim know they're pagans, and Bnei Yisrael imagine that they're monotheists. But ultimately, when you limit God's power, that is a monotheism that really transforms into Avodah Zarah, because Bnei Yisrael are no longer worshiping Hashem. Ultimately, they're worshiping themselves. The exact same thing that Chathni and Pinchas did, right? They say, hey, we're Kohanim. We can do whatever we want because we're the priests. We have the privileges. Nothing anyone can do. Nothing Hashem's going to do to turn it around. They're self-worshipping pleasure seekers. And now we have people who are self-worshipping who just try to use Hashem for their own ends. Battle ends in disaster, as we can imagine. The Plishtim devastate Bnei Yisrael. 30,000 Jews are killed. The Aron is captured. The sons of Eli are killed. And even though the Navi here doesn't mention it, we saw Matt and the Navi mentioned elsewhere, as we'll see, the Plishtim break all the way into Shiloh and the whole town is destroyed. So we'll look at the end of Parak Dalet next week. But just one thing we have to look at before we close for today. And that is that this battle in this battle of Ophek, this first battle between Bnei Yisrael and the Plishtim, is referred to a couple of other places in Tanakh. Next week, we will look at what Yirmiyahu has to say in Yirmiyahu Parak Zion. But to close out the shiur this week, I want to look at Tehillim Parak Ayin Ches. Worth looking at on your own. It's a fascinating parak. It's basically a short history of Bnei Yisrael from Egypt to David HaMelech. And what the parak in Tehillim does is it puts this battle with the Plishtim in the framework of Sefer Shoftim. And the whole introduction, basically, that we had setting up the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. Right, Tehillim says, Hashem drove the nations out. He brought us into Eretz Canaan. Right now we're in Israel. Things are good. But what happened? He says, we were a disaster. We abandoned the Torah. We betrayed God. We worshipped idols. And then, as a consequence, Hashem hurt. Hashem was angry. And Hashem destroyed the Mishkan of Shiloh. And it goes on and on. Vayitain l'shvikuzo. He gave his strength into captivity, right? Meaning the Aron, the Tifarto b'yad Tsar, his glory into the hand of the enemy. The Aron is captured. Shiloh is destroyed. The people are killed. The women can't get married. It's a shidduch crisis because all of the men have been killed. The Kohanim are et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And things are gonna turn around. And then we will come back to this. We'll come back to this. We do Parak Hey and Vav. This is a great Rashi on this pasuk here in Tehillim. But the point that I just want to extract from what Tehillim Ayin Ches is doing is, until now we've only been focusing on the sons of Eli, right, and their crime. You look at Tehillim, and Tehillim says, we can't just look at Bnei Eli. We have to look at the last, couple hundred years of Jewish history. And it's been, Bnei Yisrael have been doing Avodah Zarah. But why didn't Shmuel, Parak Dalet of Shmuel, why didn't it mention Avodah Zarah? The Malbim says, we'll see a reference to it in Parak Zion. We know the Jews are worshiping idolatry. We know there's Pesel Micha. But why isn't it presented in the text over here? And I think the most straightforward answer is that, take one quick step back. This is the same question basically we had a couple of weeks ago about Chafni and Pinchas. Remember, the Psukim again and again and again talked about Chafni and Pinchas taking meat. They're taking meat. They're taking meat. They're taking more meat. Oh, and by the way, they're committing adultery in the Mishkan. We're like, what? Right? What? Why is the more severe sin the one that gets the least amount of press in the Navi? And suggest that the answer was that the Navi isn't interested per se in what sins are happening so much as what are the religious flaws that are causing the Averos to take place. And it is the mentality that Chafni and Pinchas had that the Kahuna was purely privilege and no responsibility, and that the whole thing, the whole institution was set up just to their human benefit, and they didn't recognize any concept of serving Ribbono Shel Olam, that inevitably led to the phenomenon that they're sleeping with women in the Mishkan, right? If that's the religious perspective, this is going to be the end result. But the core of the problem was really highlighted more by seeing how they're interacting on a day-to-day basis with people who are bringing karbanos. And the same exact thing is happening here. Yes, Klal Yisrael, there's idolatry going on. But what is the core of the problem? What is the root of the idolatry? It is the religious perspective that allows B'nai Yisrael to think the Aron Kodesh will save us. We'll ask, why is Hashem doing this to us? Oh, let's bring the Aron to force God to come to our aid. It is ultimately the failure to appreciate what Hashem means. It is the failure to appreciate that Hashem is the Malach Malchei Hamlachim. He is the ultimate king. He is the one with ultimate power. And our job is not to try to manage or manipulate, God forbid, what Hashem does, but just to listen to what he says, right? Which is exactly what Chana is sitting there screaming, what Shmuel is going to be saying is exactly the respect you have to have. It is that limited view of Ribbono Shel Olam, which ultimately is Avodah Zarah. And that's exactly what the Plishtim are doing on the other side, right, said the Malbim, where they're saying, you know, oh, the Aron is there. Oh, no, God is on the other side. Okay, right, man can overcome God. I mean, so when that is their perspective of Ribbono Shel Olam, so that is the core mistake, which then leads to Avodah Zarah. So you look at Sefer Tehillim, and you say, yeah, there's idolatry happening. But what is the core of the problem? It is the fact that B'nai Yisrael, at this point in time, have not internalized the message of Chana, the message of Tefillah Chana, right? They still think it's like it's so simple, but so critical, that they just don't appreciate that Hashem is the one with unlimited power. And that is going to be the program that Shmuel is going to have to try to put into place as he tries to pick up the pieces in the aftermath of this disaster. So we'll come back next week, and we'll close out Perek Dalet, maybe add in a couple more thoughts about the battle. We'll close out the Perek, and then we'll all move forward, right? So it's like, good, like, you know, Hanukkah is the darkest time of year, right? And then things turn around. So next week, you know, it's Hanukkah, and we'll close out, this running streak of stuff that's been pretty depressing, and we'll see how the Geula begins to take shape. So wish everyone a Hanukkah Sameach, and looking forward to
Thank you very much.
Thank you.